I mean, do you guys...
Is that important, really?
Well, there's people here who do not know us.
And they haven't picked off
on you. They know you. Yeah, Drew's my business partner. That's, yeah. And, yeah, we've been best friends since he was in seventh grade and I was three. I have everything up here except a clicker. Okay, so we're going to talk about wholesaling. I see some people in the room that I absolutely know for absolute certain are not wholesalers. That's really interesting. I see some people who would no sooner sell a property than
you're here to critique.
They would jump off a cliff. So that's interesting. Hope you guys learned something, Dave. So the kind of fun thing about this presentation is that the 8:30 to 10 o'clock presentations are no sales presentations. So I'm not under any pressure to get you to sign up for wholesale school at the end of this. So we actually have whatever time Drew just left me to talk about the realities of what is happening in the market right now and what's going to happen, some of which is going to be a little scary to you, and it should be. As a wholesaler, you have got to be ready to turn on a dime at this point in the market. So how many of you are, let me start here. How many of you are already wholesalers?
Want to be.
Okay, how many of you want to be wholesalers? And why are the rest of you here? That was less than half the room. Is there a third choice? let me try again. How many of you are wholesalers?
What is wholesaling?
Yeah. Oh, what is wholesaling? Oh! How many of you don't know what wholesaling is?
Nobody in the room.
No, there's actually three or four people. Okay, and how many are already wholesalers? And how many want to be wholesalers? And are the rest of you going, I'm in the wrong class and I'm not sure how to gracefully get up and go find the one I meant to, because you could just go, it'll be fine. Okay, so how many of you are worried about what's going on in the market? Okay, less than half of you, that's interesting. It's actually wise as a wholesaler to be really watching and concerned about what is happening with interest rates having doubled since the beginning of the year, and the Fed is starting to backpedal on their language about how much longer they're going to keep doing this, but they may be backpedaling because every time they even go, yeah, we might do it again, the stock market goes, pfft. So that we don't know if that's just messaging or if they truly are going to stop raising rates. They waited too long to start raising rates, and their goal, of course, in raising rates is to quash inflation, and they have not even succeeded a little bit, and they may have to raise them a lot more. And also, historically, it takes about 18 months to 2 years for raising interest rates to have a significant effect on inflation, but that's the only tool the Fed has. So we'll see what happens. You know, we spent a couple of years just printing money like it was worthless, which it then became, and then inflation happened, and then the only tool the Fed has to control that is raising interest rates. And it could get a whole lot worse than this. The Fed actually doubled interest rates in 1979. Because again, they had waited too long to do anything about it, and they went from like 8-9% to ultimately 21%. Yeah, Dyke Spottiford's going to tell you a story tomorrow about buying his very first rental property at 21% interest and being glad to be able to do it, because that was what mortgage rates were like briefly back then. The thing is, when the market slows, when home buyers stop buying, when rental housing providers start getting nervous about, are their tenants still going to have jobs, that affects us immediately. That affects wholesalers immediately, because those are our buyers. And when our buyers get nervous, what they are willing to pay for our deals and whether they are willing to buy our deals is immediately affected. It has already affected the market. I started getting the texts about a month ago, how do I move these deals I have under contract? I've got three deals that should have sold and they haven't. And of course, what that's saying is, back in March, they'd be gone, and now it's been 2 weeks and no one's wanting them, and I'm getting nervous, okay? And when I give these wholesalers the answer of lower the price, I mean, at some price, everything will still sell, right? But what you're experiencing is some buyers who are just hanging out of the market until they see what happens, and other buyers who are still buying, but they have to get a bigger discount than they would have needed to get at the beginning of the year. So either way, you lower your price. That's how you do it. And the answer I got back was, I can't. In other words, I have it under contract for too much money, right? Because the money that you could have offered a seller in March is different than the money you can offer a seller today. And a year from now, we're going to be having that same conversation. I'm going to be saying what you could have offered in November of last year is not what you can offer in November of this year. Now, having said be concerned and take action, I am also going to say that wholesaling in a down market is a different business, but it's still a good business. In fact, I kind of love down markets as a wholesaler because I know how to deal with them and most of my competitors don't. I fully expect any day now to start seeing, you know those guys that you've always admired because they wholesale 50 to 100 deals a month? Do you know somebody like that in your market? A company like that in your market? They will start shutting their doors within a month. And here's why. They're not really wholesalers. To me, a wholesaler is somebody who does a business-to-business transaction with another professional investor and who is selling properties at wholesale prices, right? And wholesale price has a specific meaning that I'll tell you in a minute. What these companies have been doing for the last 5 years is selling deals at 85 or 90 cents on the dollar, sometimes 100 cents on the dollar, by the time you take into account the real repair costs, because if you've ever seen one of their leads, they're like, it only needs $20,000 in work, just a roof, HVAC, windows, landscaping, paint, carpet, water heater, rewiring, remove the walls, kitchen, bath, you know, and you're... If you know what it really costs to do that kind of renovation, you're like, okay, $20,000 might pay for the materials if you bought them at a scrapyard, right? Like it's nowhere near reality. So when they are giving, let's just call it materials only prices on the rehabs, and when they are saying this property's worth $385 fixed up, and you're looking at the comps, and nothing has ever sold for more than $320 in that neighborhood, who are they selling to? Yeah, newbies, out-of-town sellers, those out-of-town buyers who don't really know the values in the area. No, hedge funds actually have a formula, and they're pretty professional about...
Their formula came down, though.
Their formula did come down. It isn't...
Like 87% minus repairs.
It is not... They are still your best buyers in terms of what they'll pay. We're talking about hedge funds here, the companies that buy up hundreds and hundreds of rentals in an area. But the issue with hedge funds is they're also extremely picky about what they'll buy. Like we've got one here that every time I have a 3-bedroom, 1.5-bath slab ranch in particular neighborhoods that was built after 1960, I call them because they will pay more than anybody else for that house.
They were paying 125% of ARV minus repairs. Now they're at 87.
Yeah, and now they won't do that anymore. But also, if I have a more typical Cincinnati house, which is going to be a 2-story, 100-year-old house, they don't want that. They want real specific stuff. So the companies that have been showing up at your group bragging about how they do 50 to 100 deals a month, part of the reason they're able to do that is they have gigantic marketing budgets. I'm talking $50,000 a month, probably, in direct mail, cold calling, all of that sort of stuff. They have enormous staff to process those things, and therefore they have an enormous monthly nut. Right, like they have to make $100,000 before they take a dollar out of the business. The first $100,000 goes into paying for their office space and their subscriptions and their marketing and all that sort of stuff. They can normally survive about 1 to 2 months once the newbies and the out-of-state owners kind of go, I don't know about the market right now, and we're going into month two. And I know this because I saw it happen in 2007. And that's, bad for them. And whenever I've had the opportunity, I have sat down with the owners of those businesses and said, what are you going to do when the market turns? And across the board, what I've been told is, don't be silly, old lady. We've got a business model that will never stop working. So I like down markets because I know how to use them. So here's my instruction to you. Don't let your emotion about the fact that everything you are hearing about the real estate market right now sounds like bad news. An article came out in the Cincinnati Inquirer the other day who has been doing a year-long expose on how investors are affecting the market. And it's done endless articles about how Cincinnati has the highest increase in rent rates in the country. Now, I'm sure wherever you live, you've seen the same article about your town and how housing is unaffordable, blah, 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 blah. Rents went down in Cincinnati for the second month in a row last month. And they published it. Thank God. I thought that would just get buried. 17% of pending sales went down last month in the whole country. 17% of properties under contract did not close and will not close because the buyers got cold feet and backed out, or because the buyers didn't have a rate lock, and when the rates went up, they couldn't qualify anymore. So, I mean, this all sounds like terrible, terrible news. That's because you're thinking like a seller, not a buyer. If you're thinking like a buyer, you're going, this is great. This is going to produce so many motivated sellers. Oh, my God. So don't let the fact that what the media is saying to you is always couched as if it were bad news. Talk to your fellow investors and see how they feel about it, because I think pretty much across the board you're going to feel like they think it's good news. You just have to understand where the challenges are and overcome them, and understand where the opportunities are and grab them. So we're going to talk about how to go about doing this. First, I want to talk about the 2007 real estate bubble, because I'm still seeing stuff, debates online, and I've had some of them in person, about this is going to be much worse than 2007. Right. Like, we haven't even started to see, I mean, that was baby stuff. This is going to be like, I don't even know what to compare it to. Post-war Japan. Like, this is going to be the worst thing anybody has ever seen in the history of the world. So let's walk through what happened there for those of you who weren't born yet. Okay, there might be a couple of those in here. So late 2006, what we saw was that markets, especially on the coast, in the traditionally hot, bubble markets, had started to turn. Properties were hanging on the market longer. Prices were starting to go down. Foreclosure rates were starting to go up. Because if you're in foreclosure and your house doesn't sell, you go all the way into foreclosure, right? By mid-2007, and this seemed really fast to those of us who were in it. It was like late 2006. We're like, oh, look, San Francisco house prices went down. And in July of 2007, the market dropped dead. And the reason it dropped dead is because in about a two-week period, every subprime lender in the country went out of business. And it was the subprime lending market that was keeping that crazy market that happened in 04, 05, 06 afloat. Anybody could get a loan. I'm serious. Like, if you had a driver's license, and when they held a mirror in front of your nose, it fogged up, they would give you more money to buy a house than you needed to buy a house. It was terrible, terrible loans being made, and once somebody looked under the blanket and went, oh my God, these are all terrible loans, then no one would buy them on the secondary market. And so the people who were making them, who had to sell them on the secondary market to get the money to make some more, couldn't make any more loans. By mid-08, my portfolio of rentals were worth less than the loans against them. And I never took out 100% loans. I never financed a property for more than 70% of whatever I thought the value was. But the values had dropped so precipitously that if you looked at my entire portfolio, it was overfinanced. And also, 10%, 11% of Americans were unemployed, including a bunch of my tenants. And so I had to lower my rents, either to keep my good tenants or to re-rent the places to good tenants. So it was kind of ugly, but I didn't lose one single house, didn't miss a payment, because while that business was kind of, oh my gosh, when is this going to stop? When are the values going to stop dropping, and when are my rents going to stop dropping? I ramped up my wholesaling business. My wholesaling business was in part supporting my rental business. So during the Great Recession in 2008, which was really the first full year where it was clear that there were just literally, in the Cincinnati MLS at one point, there were 7,800 bank-owned properties. Yeah. And then lots of people trying desperately to sell their houses to avoid it being a bank-owned property. And then, I mean, it was really obvious in 2008 that things were not moving. And part of the reason things were not moving, even as prices dropped and dropped and dropped, is because after the banks made all those dumb loans, they pulled back and started making, like, no loans. There was a moment there where people with 800 credit scores were being turned down for loans because the banks just didn't like real estate as an asset at that moment. They were afraid they'd loan, 80% of $200,000, and then the next week the house would only be worth $100,000. They didn't know either, right? So in 2008, I still wholesaled 30 properties, and in 2009, once I had really figured out what I needed to do, I wholesaled 60 properties. And this is at the same time as all my competitors are, like, going out of business. What did I learn between 2008 and 2009? I learned what buyers would buy, which was rental properties that needed less than $20,000 in work, so they could really be completed in a week or so, and that were priced at about 65 cents on the dollar less repairs, and that would cash flow, even at the lower rents, at least $200 a month. They were rental properties, so rental and bread and butter neighborhoods, priced at 65 cents on the dollar, less repair costs, that needed less than $20,000 in work. That was the interesting part. I couldn't get somebody to buy a house that needed $50,000 in work, even if it was priced at 50 cents on the dollar, because they were like, why would I do that? There's all these bank-owned properties that people have rehabbed in the last 2 years, and yes, the plumbing is gone, but I can replace that in a day. And other than that, they need paint, and they're ready to go. Why would I buy a house that needed $50,000 worth of work? And the cash flow at least $200 a month. So that was thing one I learned, is what did the buyers want? And the second thing that I learned was the focus of my business had to be recruiting buyers. What has the focus of the wholesaling business been in the last 5 years? Finding sellers. Didn't need to find buyers. I mean, you needed to find buyers, but you didn't have to actually put any effort into that. An ad on Facebook would sell any good deal you had in a day, right? I learned that I needed to put my focus on finding buyers. So By late 2008, we were doing all kinds of things with buyers, because I figured out that they had these issues, and even the experienced ones that I like to work with had these two issues on their mind. Number one, how do I tell what a property's worth? There are very few sales. The sales that there are all bank-owned properties. Like there's no ARV sales, which is what we're always looking for. They're all trashed bank-owned properties. I don't know how to know what the right price is. So I did some classes. And the classes were how to figure out what a property is going to make. Because if you're a rental housing provider, it really doesn't matter what the house is worth. It matters how much it's going to make. And I would do these classes where I'd say, here's how you evaluate what your rental income is going to be. And by the way, if you're making $500 a month, do you care if you pay $1 million for a house? I mean, like, the value doesn't matter. What matters is the cash flow, right? The other thing that I discovered was a lot of my cash buyers were relying on lines of credit that had gotten pulled, home equity lines that had gotten shut down because the banks just didn't like real estate anymore, or private lenders who were scared of the market. And a handful of them, hard money lenders. That was the other, man, you could not find a hard money lender to save your life in 2009. Like the companies out here, they didn't exist. there had been, when we did OREA in 2006, we had 70 vendors and 35 of them were hard money lenders. I mean, that's how hot the hard money market was at that time. In 2008, there were zero because all of the big national hard money lenders had gotten their lines of credit pulled by the banks. They had no money to lend, and also a whole bunch of their loans went bad. And a lot of them ended up bankrupt. So my buyers who depended on hard money, there was no hard money. So the other thing that I taught them, the other class I did was how to raise money from private lenders and partners. So with those two problems solved, they were able to buy 60 properties from me that year. It was really cool. So in 2011, I bought a package of 16 properties in Columbus, Ohio for $72,000 from a bank who was offloading a whole bunch of REOs all at once. And I turned around and sold them for a profit of $100,000. I mean, when you do the math there, I paid $4,500 a piece for those properties. In 2011, I bought 11 from a bank in Cincinnati that were also in default. And I sold them for a total profit of $65,000. You just haven't heard about deals like that since about 2012, 2013, right? Because since 2012, 2013, the market has done nothing but go up. These are the kind of deals that we could see again coming up in the next year or so. So keep your eyes open for those. Now, the thing is, I just described what happened in 2007. This is not 2007. This is a normal mid-cycle slowdown. In fact, it's delayed. I gave a talk at OREA in 2019 called How to Wholesale Houses in the Coming Recession. And the reason was we had seen that thing where on the coasts, Seattle had 3 months in a row of dropping prices. San Francisco had 3 months in a row of dropping prices. And I was like, here it comes. It's going to be good. And then COVID happened. And the government wrote Americans $1 billion worth of checks. Right? And that actually delayed. We had a recession coming. It was actually even a little overdue in 2019. And we had a pandemic, and we had a bunch of government intervention, and that slowed down the recession, but probably deepened it. Yeah. It would be over by now if it had just been allowed to happen, but it probably deepened it because pouring a bunch of dollars into Americans' pockets when there is nothing for them to spend it on is problematic. It raises prices, right? I've got all this money, and oh look, plane tickets are available again. Let me go buy one. Oh gosh, look, they've doubled. Because everybody wants to buy them now, and there's only so many. So we're really looking at more like the 01 recession that followed the tech wreck and then got deepened by 9/11. We're not looking at this. We won't be looking at this until probably 2006, 7, something like that. 2000. Well, the 18-year cycle is due to end in 06, but since we got delayed 2 years, will it be 26? Will it be 26, 27, 28? Don't know. Speaking of which, how many of you guys were investing in real estate through that 07, 8, 9? Okay, so look around, guys. It's less than 5% of the room. How many of you are looking forward to that happening again because now you know what to do? You what?
There were tons of $5,000 houses.
$5,000 houses that you could put $5,000 into fixing up and then rent for $650 a month.
Yeah. Well,
and none of us feel like we bought enough of those. Like now we're like, man. Because we've all seen what's happened since then, right? And the right strategy, I now know, would have been to buy more of those than I needed.
Yes.
Like buy about 50. And then wait 5 years and start selling off the ones I didn't like and paying off the ones I did like. And I would have ended up with 25 free and clear rental properties. And that's usually what people need to be an ender is 25 free and clear rental properties. So it's not 2007 because one of the things we had going on in 2007 was we had overbuilding. There were too many houses being built for the number of people who actually wanted to live in them. And the reason builders were building so many houses is because investors were willing to go buy them pre-construction because the thought was, given how the market had been, when it's done in 9 months, I won't even have to close it. I'll be able to sell it for 20% more than I paid for it, which worked for the first couple of years and then didn't because there were too many houses. And we clearly don't have that. We don't have too many houses and we don't have an excess of rental properties. We don't have those, you know, tidal waves of bad loans. Well, when I say bad loans, I mean loans that were bad when they were made. Our biggest problem in this regard is going to be FHA loans. FHA is probably going to be in trouble. If it was possible to make a investment in FHA, by which I mean bet against them, I would be doing that right now. But unfortunately, it's a government entity. They've been making a lot of 3% down, 580 credit score kind of loans, and those are going to be the ones that we see go bad, but they're not, you know, Fannie and Freddie are 70% of the market. FHA is not that huge a piece of the market. There was a complete lack of conventional financing available for people to buy back then. There is not a lack now. It's just more expensive than it was. Banks are still making loans. It's just more expensive. And we've got all these experienced buyers who went through 07 who are going, this is great. Let me buy some properties. Well, the property buying is good. So in a recession, just generally, of course, Americans lose jobs or they lose hours at their jobs. And they lose value in their 401ks. That's already happened. People who have their 401k money invested in the stock market, it's a lot less money than it was at the beginning of the year. And so they stop thinking about big investments like houses. They say, oh, we better put it off until we make sure that the job's steady. And that causes supply to increase, which causes prices to drop. And it also becomes harder to tell what any given property is worth. And I'll come back to that in a minute because that's important for us as wholesalers. Our buyers, not home buyers, not the general real estate buyer market, change too because all that dumb money, all that, well, I'm a new investor and I can't find a deal and I'm not sure if this is a deal or not. I've actually had people tell me this. I just want to do it to get the experience. I've had people tell me that many times. I know it's not that great a deal, but I haven't been able to find one. And so I'm just going to do this to get the experience. And I always say, look, I'll tell you what. You just give me the $10,000 you're going to lose, and I will explain the experience that you're going to have here. So newbie buyers just like, they stop buying because they are particularly affected by what they're hearing the media say, and they start going, oh, it's a bad market, because they don't understand that there's no such thing as a bad market. There's a bad market if you're a buyer, and there's a bad market if you're a seller, but they're opposite markets. So in one or the other is always a good market for you. Who you have left is experienced enders and experienced estate builders who they haven't been buying as much as they would want to buy in the last 5 years because they would rather not buy than buy a bad deal. And now that they see some good deals coming, they're like, gonna line up my private lenders, gonna line up my money, gonna get my IRA in a place where I can invest it. The other people that we got a lot of in 2001, and you may be seeing this at your REIA group, is people who, they're not like a lot of you guys who, like, you kind of always had a thing for real estate. They haven't always had a thing for real estate. What they have is a thing for retiring someday. And they are refugees from the stock market right now because they're like, it's just going down and down and down, and I need something I can control. And so they get interested in becoming real estate investors. They start coming to REIA meetings, and they pretty quickly discover they don't really want to do the work. And if they happen to hear about private lending before they stop coming to meetings, that's what they're attracted to. They've got cash, but they've also got full-time jobs, and they start hearing the rehabber horror stories, and they often come in with, I don't want to have tenants, I don't want to have a property manager deal with my tenants. If they hear about private lending, that's what they want to do, or partnering. They want to partner in other people's deals with their cash. These folks get a lot more conservative. I'm talking now about the experienced people get a lot more conservative in what they want to pay for a property. When they know there's going to be a lot of bargains, they're looking for the best of them. So wholesalers, all of this means is motivated sellers get a lot more common because the economy is motivating them. You're not motivating them. The economy is motivating them. And they're getting less mail. They're getting less cold calls. They're getting less ringless voicemails. They don't have that feeling that everybody in the world wants my house, and I don't even know why. All of a sudden, I just started getting all these people wanting my house. They're not getting that feeling as much, and they're reading the same thing you're reading, right? That the market is turning cold, and they have the experience, we'll come back to here in a moment, of several, maybe, wholesalers putting their property under contract and then not closing. And that sort of motivates them, right? I have talked to 3 sellers in the last 2 weeks who said, well, I have a guy who offered me $200,000. Okay, when you say offered me, did he actually write a offer? No, he told me he'd pay me $200,000. Okay, has he put that on paper? No, and I can't get hold of him. So, I mean, that's a good moment for them when that, you know, $200,000 is the price that'll work for them, and they're like, oh, yeah, thanks, Russell, somebody's going to do that. And then the potential buyer goes dark. You know, that starts to feel like, oh my God, this is going to be bad because I'm under some kind of time pressure. Your competition is going to die down a lot. And if you can make these changes and be one of the few wholesalers still around for these experienced buyers who want to buy, you're going to kill it. It's going to be a really good couple of years for you. So you need to really understand how the wholesaling process works. You need to have the best buyers on your buyer list, the ones that you have been afraid to talk to up until now, the ones who have intimidated you. Because you're like, I'm a newbie, and that guy's, every time I come to the meeting, that guy's surrounded by people, and I'm I don't have anything good to say, so I'm just going to not talk to him. I'm going to talk to the other newbies. I always talk to the most experienced person that you can go stand next to. They need to be on your list. You need to understand what it is they're looking for, because they are the ones who are reliable about buying, and you need to be able to give them what they want. So what has not changed is the process. Right? There's just a series of steps you have to go through to wholesale a deal, and it's always going to be the same process. Doesn't matter what's happening in the economy. You have to find a way to get leads. You have to talk to the sellers and find out what's going on with them and what's going to solve their problem. If they're motivated, you move on to the next step. If they're not motivated, don't go see their house and spend an hour inspecting it and talking. I mean, sellers are like boyfriends. One of the things that I have learned about men is that if they tell you they're not good enough for you, they're right. And only girls in their teens and 20s spend any time going, no, you're awesome. Really. No, he's telling you the truth, okay? Sellers are the same way. If they're telling you they're not motivated, they're not lying. There's not some secret thing that's going on. Every once in a great while, I'm saying maybe 1% of sellers I talk to initially fool me about their motivation level. In other words, they're talking like they're not motivated, and they truly are convincing about it. Most sellers who are trying to play the negotiation game by saying, it's 150,000 cash or nothing. If you talk to them for another 5 minutes, you start to see cracks in that, because they can't lie consistently. Every once in a while, I get one who truly is motivated and is so good at negotiating or acting that I don't realize it until I make the offer and they accept it. But most of the time, if they say they're motivated, they are. If they say they're not, they're not. So if they're not motivated, follow up with them every couple of months, but don't go in and down the hill with your hair on fire, comping their property and going out to see it and all that sort of stuff. So if they're motivated, you do go see the property, you evaluate it, figure out the ARV and the repair costs, you make the offer. It will either initially be accepted or rejected. If it's rejected, you follow up with them every month just to check in, I was thinking about you. Did you get that house sold? If it is accepted, you sign the purchase agreement, you start the title work, you find a buyer, you get paid, and you go to closing. It's always the process. It doesn't matter. What changes is where you're focusing your energy in that process. And where you're going to be focusing your energy for the next 18 months maybe is on the buyer finding. Part. The deal finding part's about to get a lot easier. So your buyer's always an investor. That is always going to be true. It's always going to be an investor who pays cash, by which I mean they're not trying to go to a conventional bank and get a loan on this deal that you don't even own. Because banks can't finance through contract assignments. The seller would have to be directly in contract with your buyer. So you need a buyer who literally is paying cash or is getting a private loan or a hard money loan. Your buyers over the next 18 months are going to be more experienced than you are used to. They will be people with private money or lines of credit. They're very excited about buying, but also, you cannot fool them with bad numbers. In fact, if you send them bad numbers, they'll probably just block your emails and never look at another deal. I mean, that's such a waste of time. Every experienced buyer in this room, including me, will tell you that there's a list of email addresses and text numbers that they don't even pay any attention to anymore, because every deal they've seen from that person is a bad deal, and so there's no use even going to comp it. And that's sad, because even if that wholesaler becomes good at what they're doing, they're already on my ignore them list. It will take a lot to get them off of my ignore them list. Now, here's the other thing. The best buyers in the market last few years have been flippers. They've been people who are going to buy, fix, and sell the property. And as the market has gotten hotter and hotter, the properties that they would buy have gone from, I only want stuff in move-up neighborhoods, to I'll take stuff in bread-and-butter neighborhoods, to I will take stuff in rental neighborhoods because I can fix those and sell them to homeowners now. Okay, that bottom level? Nope. It's going to be bread and butter and move up for the retailers only, and it's probably going to be move up for the retailers only, and the retailers are the ones that I'm talking to right now who are most saying, I need to be careful. I'm not going to be trying to do two rehabs at once. I'm reevaluating what I will pay based on the fact that I think a property could be on the market for 2 or 3 months now before I could sell it. And I don't know if when it's done in 6 months, it's still going to be worth what it's worth today. So they are the ones who are being most conservative in whether or what they will buy. Rental owners are going to become a much bigger portion of your buyer pool. They care more about cash flow than about what the property's worth in a year, because they don't have a short-term, I need to sell it in a year or I'm not going to make a profit, or I need to sell it in the next 3 months or I'm not going to make a profit view. So let me give you an example. This is a property, if you live in Cincinnati, it's in Oakley. It's kind of a retail property. I mean, Oakley's like a nice, you know, move-up neighborhood. This particular one is on a busy street, which would normally make it not something that a retailer would want, but it's Oakley. I mean, it's one of those neighborhoods where if you have a shack in somebody's backyard, you can probably turn it into a tiny house and sell it. I mean, it's like that kind of neighborhood. So it's a weirdly laid out 6-room, 3-bedroom, 1-bath with a 260 ARV. To repair it for rental would only be about $7,000. But to do what you normally would do in a house in Oakley for retail, you know, move walls and make the kitchen bigger and add another bath, all that stuff, it'd be about a $50,000 rehab job. This weird little 3-bedroom, 1-bath will rent for $1,600 a month in Oakley. I put it under contract for $125, and I sold the contract for $10. So in other words, somebody gave me $10,000 and then I assigned them the contract. A retailer looks at this deal very differently right now than a rental owner does. And I did sell it to a rental owner, which was interesting because I'll tell you, in 2019, it would have been a retailer for sure. So here's how a retailer is looking at this deal. I have to borrow $135 to buy it, my $125 price plus my $10, and I need to borrow $50,000 to fix it, and that's going to be at hard money rates. And so that's, you know, $185 for a house that might or might not be worth $260 in 5 months when I'm done with it. My hard money lender is saying I have to put down $20,000 to get that loan. That's a lot of money to risk. And that makes my payment over $2,000 a month, including taxes and insurance. And that's just too big a risk until I see what the market is going to do. The rental housing provider I sold it to did this math. I borrow $142 because I only need $135 plus $7. I can borrow it from a private lender at 8%, not 12, right? Not 12 and 2 points. I can have it fixed in a week because I'm only doing a rental rehab. I can then rent it for $1,600 a month, which gives me $300 a month in net cash flow. If I want to, later, I can go ahead and, you know, do the full fix up and sell it for $260 or something, depending on what the market's doing right now. Or I could take my hard money lender out with a bank loan in a year at probably the same 8%, but amortized over 30 years. Private lenders don't tend to want to amortize over 30 years. And if I do that, I'll have more cash flow. So the retailer has very few options about how they're going to make money, right? It's just, it's got to sell, and it's got to sell at the price I think it's going to sell for, and it's got to sell pretty quickly, so holding costs don't eat me. The rental housing providers, like, I got plan A, I got plan B, I got plan C. As long as it's cash flowing, I'm good. Because I don't need to sell it to make my profit. That evaluation that I just walked you through is a typical experienced investor evaluation. If you're used to looking at everything as what's it worth in cash, you need to learn how to take on this mindset and say, okay, but what would a rental owner do? These guys have access to partners, to private lenders, to lines of credit, and they're typically qualified to refinance with a bank if they want to do that. You need these experienced investors. Best place to get them is probably at your REIA meetings. If you're lucky enough to belong to a group that has, like, online haves and wants meetings where people get on and say what they want and say what they have to offer, you need to be attending those religiously.
Like ours,
yes. Were you in the room last night when Anita was talking about?
Oh, I'll talk to you about that.
Okay. So the experienced investors you're looking for are actually kind of more likely to attend any given online meeting than they are to attend any given live meeting, because part of being experienced in an estate builder is you're really busy. You've always got a real estate thing you need to be doing, but it's easy to jump on a Zoom meeting, right? And we get a lot of people who we don't see at in-person meetings on those Zoom meetings. You have to be one of the wholesalers that they respect, because there's a lot of them they don't, I can tell you that. And the way you become one of the ones they respect is you know your business and you're open to feedback. If you offer them a deal and they say, no, I'm not buying this, it's a terrible deal, don't be like, well, pfft. Says you. Say, teach me. What is it about this deal you don't like? And I will do better next time. At what price would this be a good deal for you? Maybe I'll try and get that price, right? The people that the experienced investors don't respect are the wholesalers, like, I got the greatest deal in the whole wide world. Here's a bad AOV and bad repair costs. And
an overpriced wholesale fleet.
And when you call them and say, I would be happy to buy this at like $20,000 less than what you're asking, they're like, screw you. I can sell anything to anybody. I'm like, okay, don't even want help, okay.
Call you back next week.
Oh, they're not going to call me back ever because I'm going to block their number. And they have this long-term view on the market. That's the important thing. So, sellers. It is always the case that the sellers we need are the ones who need to sell. We're not interested in somebody because they have a property and they want to sell it. We're interested in somebody because they have a property and they need to sell it. They always need to sell it because of some story, something's going on with them. And of course, there's a lot of stories, right? I'm in foreclosure. I inherited this house. I'm getting divorced. The guy who's like, yeah, I'm thinking about maybe retiring to Florida in a couple of years because my wife is hassling me. And they got your postcard, and I said, yeah, let's see what they'll pay for it. That's not your seller. That's not even a seller, I would argue. Not for another 2 years, anyway. The thing is, in a recession, more is going on with homeowners than when the economy is great. Finding the deals has been the hard part because the market has been so hot and competition has been so fierce. Every seller, even, you know, I'm getting divorced and in foreclosure, and it's a race to the courthouse steps because the tax people are also foreclosing on me, and my house is a disaster, which I inherited. You know, even that seller was getting multiple offers if they ever bothered to reach out to anybody to sell. This is like my favorite phone call to get in 2020. I have this house, and it needs a lot of work, and I know I need to sell it to investors. So I called all of the 58 postcards and letters I got, and on Monday, I'm just going to open the door, and whoever gives me the top offer, I'm going to take it. And my response to that was always, okay, that's not going to be me, so I'm not going to show up. Whoever does give you the top offer, take it, I guess. But I'm going to call you in 30 days and see if it actually closed. And if it didn't, we can talk. Because I will not make the top offer because I actually know what houses are worth. And the people who are going to make you the top offer do not know what they're worth, and they won't be able to close it. So we can talk after you've gotten through that process. My recent sellers are a different set of people than they would have been in 2019. Getting a lot of calls from people who have not made a payment on their house since March of 2020. And they, in many cases, there's the ones who couldn't make the payments. And then there's the ones who they heard that they didn't have to make payments, and so they didn't. And then something subsequently happened. You know, they figured out, I'll get the loan modification when those become available, and they're not able to get the loan modification. That's what I'm hearing over and over and over again, is I thought I was going to be able to get a loan modification. I heard that they were going to move the back payments to the back of the loan, and I applied for one, and they said no, because they didn't understand that loan modifications aren't automatic. You actually have to qualify for them. You have to re-qualify for your own loan. You have to be able to prove that you can make that you have the income to make the payments that are going to result from this modification.
You're talking about after they've already held up your, waited for you to pay your payments and moved it, but now you've got to re-qualify.
No, in order for them to move the payments to the back of the loan, you have to re-qualify for that loan. And
you have to be behind payments.
Or later, when it's now time to...
You don't get the modification. So the modifications weren't actually available for a few months. And then they were, but there was still the foreclosure moratorium, so people didn't apply for them. And then the forbearances have all rolled out now. I think they're still seeing some.
I'm still seeing some, but they're waiting until the end to see what their options are.
Yeah.
Some of them it's too late.
Yeah, so the forbearance, which was okay, you just don't have to pay us. That started rolling out in December of last year. In other words, people got to the end of their forbearance in December, and most of them had rolled out by May. Now, Courtney's saying she's still seeing a couple that got in late, and so they've still got a few months on their forbearance.
I am seeing that FHA is doing something as well. There's an FHA product. I'm waiting to hear more about it, but they're making an offer on a few people. So, they're hearing about this. Oh, this can help you, but if they don't qualify, they don't qualify.
Yeah, because these homeowners, they hear this stuff, but they don't understand there's going to be strings attached. They think the government's just going to save them. And the strings attached are, if you didn't go back to work because you're part of the Great Resignation, you ain't getting the loan modification because you don't have the income to pay the payments. Or if you followed your heart from your job as corporate lawyer to barista, chances are you are not getting a loan modification. And this is important, because this is a group of people who is very confused, and they're very upset because they're now facing losing their houses, and they didn't even think that was a possibility when this all started. So you need to be marketing to them, but you need to be handling them delicately, and you need to be educating them. Did you ask for a loan modification? Yes. What did they say? They said no. Why did they say no? They didn't tell me why. Let's call them up and find out why.
Yeah, I feel like they keep saying, well, the government's going to save me some way.
Well, I guess they're waiting till Tuesday to see if that's true. We can't keep pumping cash into the economy. I mean, do you guys want to be paying $300 for a McDonald's hamburger? Because if we keep pumping cash into the economy, this is not speculation. Go look at Venezuela and Argentina. This is just what happens. Look at Weimar Germany. This is what happens when you put a lot of cash into the economy. So the other people I'm hearing from that I have not heard from in a long time is ones whose listings have expired. Or their house has been listed for 2 months, and they're starting to panic because their neighbor sold in 2 days. And they're like, I don't know what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on. No one can afford your house at current interest rates. Let's talk about what price we could pay. Lots of sellers who've already been under contract with wholesalers. Oh, so many. Oh, so many. I had a buyer who was going to pay me X, but it was supposed to close a week ago, and I can't get a hold of them. Okay, does your contract say, like, a week ago was the last day? Yeah, well, then we can talk, and let me explain to you what happened. That's the conversation I'm having with those folks. Rental owners, I'm getting a lot of calls from rental owners who have decided that the market for both prices and rents has peaked, and this would be a good time to sell. So these are the four main kinds of people that I am hearing from right now. In the coming months, we will see more rental owners who bought their properties in the last couple of years, and they bought them at prices where it had to rent for X dollars, or they can't cover their payments. These are going to be short sale candidates, because if the rents drop $100, they cannot afford their payments. From foreclosures and tax foreclosures, the number of foreclosure filings has skyrocketed all around the country. And we're going to start seeing bank-owned properties again, which we haven't seen in a while, and expired listings. So these are the people you need to be focusing more of your efforts on than you have been in the past. We're going to see fewer competitors. Yay! We're going to see fewer people getting mailings. We're going to see fewer cold calls and mass texts, which is a sucky way, by the way, to contact sellers. I know there's people selling whole programs of, we'll do your mass calls and texts for you. But every time someone says, should I do cold calls? You know, should I buy a list, skip trace the list, and start calling people? And my answer is always, do you like it when people do that to you? Or does it really annoy you? If the answer is, I love it, then go ahead. If the answer is, no, it drives me crazy, I'm starting to get... The National Association of Realtors, or the Ohio Association of Realtors, somebody's clearly selling my phone number, which I don't remember giving them permission to do. And because it is insurance season, it's health insurance, you know, we're getting into that window where you can change your health insurance. I've gotten 4 texts in the last 2 days saying, hey, good news, Blue Cross has opened up in your neighborhood. Would you like me to give you a quote? And I'm like, no, I'd like you to take me off the list. It's really annoying, right? I hate it that this has become a thing in the real estate business, because it's a further nail in our these are bad people coffin.
So I think when we call them and we develop that relationship with them, they'll be more likely to do business with us as opposed to those, you know, people that didn't speak to them.
First thing is, I want them to call me, not the other way around. Second thing is, I have no objection to calling people. I just have an objection to cold calling people. I have bought deals by, you know, I'm driving up the street and I see a whole house of furniture on the curb. And what does that mean?
Eviction.
There was an eviction that day. Because if it was yesterday, the neighbors would have come and stolen all the furniture. And writing down the address and skip tracing the owner and saying, hey, it's Sabina Jones Cox. I just drove by your house at 1853 Knox. That was one of the properties I bought because of this. Looks like you might have had a set out today. Are you looking to sell that by any chance? Because that's not a cold call, right? That's like almost a warm call. I can talk to them about that property and what I saw at that property.
Right.
My marketing advice is keep doing it. Your competitors are cutting way back, which is good for you. I can tell you that we've just kept right on going right through COVID, right through, you know, we just never stopped. We're getting more calls and better calls than we have. And if you have talked to any sellers in the last year who turned you down or seemed unmotivated or whatever, call them back. Just check in, right? Hey, I was looking through my files and And we talked a year ago, and I want to close the file. I wanted to call and check in and see, did you get that house sold? Did you get the price you wanted? Oh, you did. That's great, man. You timed the market well. Or if they didn't, are you still looking to sell it? Because I'm still in the market, but what I'm offering on houses is kind of going down every month. And I think that's true of everybody. Follow up with all sellers that you talk to who aren't aggressive or obnoxious over the next 6 months to a year. So when you get calls now going forward, put them, you know, once you've talked to somebody, if you haven't made a deal, put them on your list to follow up with.
Today, are you getting a higher response rate from your mailings than you were 6 months ago?
Moderately, but that will increase and increase and increase and increase over the next year. This is a property, Sergio, you know this one. I put this house under contract on Tuesday. It's worth about $140,000. It needs about $30,000 in work. I started talking to the seller in July. I put it under contract on Tuesday. And we had a pretty constant back and forth stream of texts and phone calls and whatnot because he had tenants in the property who were supposed to move like 2 weeks after the first time we talked because they were buying a house, and then that got delayed, and then they couldn't get a rate lock, and then he didn't want to sell it while they were there. I was like, I'll buy it while they're there, and he's like, no. They finally closed like right at the middle of October, in the beginning of October, and got moved out. And then he tried to put me off again. He's like, I've got a whole bunch of stuff in the garage that I've got to get moved out. And I said, no, you don't. I mean, I haven't even seen the house at this point. I'm like, trust me, we will look past your stuff. But we need to get you an offer because literally the value of your house has dropped since July. And it's going to drop more. So every month he was getting more and more, you know, I know, but I can't get him out. And he accepted the very first offer I made him, which was last Friday, I guess, which was $62,000 subject to his $58,000 loan. Now, I had some questions about, you know, how does that subject to work and whatnot, but, you know, I told him, he said, I'm going to go talk to my wife. He called me back the next day and said, yeah, I think we're going to take that. And I was like, that's good, because it'll be a different offer next month. So the thing that is going to kill you in this market is going to be if you don't know how to evaluate properties. And unfortunately, the last few years has taught people that they can wholesale deals even if they get the numbers wrong. Not all of them, they can't wholesale all of them, but they can, you know, sell to people who don't know how to buy, even with bad numbers. In a hot market, you can do that because there's a lot of motivated buyers in a hot market. In a cold market, only good deals sell. And everything else, you got to go back to your seller and say, gosh, I'm really sorry that I told you I could pay this for your property because I can't. You got to get your numbers right, okay? So if you don't know how to do these things, go learn it. Number one, you need to be able to find after-repaired value, and we're going to come back to how that changes here in a moment. Number two, you've got to be able to walk through a property and be able to say, here's what it needs. Now, what helps you a lot with that is having a property inspection form that you carry with you, because otherwise you will forget to look at stuff. You will forget to look at the windows. If there's not a line that says windows, and you look at it and go, oh, that's not filled out. Drew has been known... He did this a month ago. He missed a bedroom in a house. Wow. Yeah, he calls me back and he's like, well, it needs like, you know, $50,000 worth of work. And I said, well, what about the bedroom in the attic? And he's like, there's no bedroom in the attic. And I said, yes, there is. The seller said so and the county says so. Well, I didn't see it. That's bad. You know, you can't do a good inspection if you're not remembering to look at everything. And then you also have to be able to take your form back where you said, looks like it needs a water heater, definitely needs a kitchen, and put numbers to that. And the numbers have changed. You guys know that, right? What we were calculating for repair costs in 2019 is not what we're calculating for repair costs today. It's a higher repair cost.
Jerry just did a seminar.
Jerry just did a seminar, an all-day seminar. He actually did a meeting and then an all-day seminar where he went and updated us all on what the current repair numbers are, which was shocking. It was shocking, but they're right. Those are correct numbers.
Do you think those numbers are going to go down?
Yes, I do think those numbers will go down. And I think those numbers will go down because I'm talking to a lot of contractors who suddenly have available time.
Home builders.
They can't get jobs with home builders because the home builders have, they're finishing up what they've started and they're not even asking for new building permits. And then also a lot of homeowners who have been our biggest competition in wanting to hire contractors are figuring out that, yes, my dream kitchen would be awesome to have, but I can't put $50,000 into it when I don't think my house is going to be worth $50,000 more as a result. So there are fewer comps in a buyer's market because just not as many houses sell, and you have to tighten up what time range you're looking in. You know, before we could say, well, let's look back a year and just understand that a house that sold a year ago would sell for more if it was going onto the market today. Now we got the opposite problem, and we need to be looking at comps really over the last 6 months, which is problematic because fewer and fewer houses are selling.
Yeah.
It gets harder to find a reasonable number of comps. So what you have to start doing is say, all right, fine, I've only got two comps in the last 6 months. I'm going to look back a year, but I'm going to assume that it would sell for the same or less today if it went on the market. The ARB is no longer the top comp. It's no longer the top comp. It used to be if we saw sales at 240, 250, and 260, we'd go, okay, it's worth at least 260. Our retailers are probably going to look at that and go, by the time I'm ready to sell, it'll be 275. But we're going to use 260. We're going to use the top comp. Now, if I saw 240, 250, and 260, I'd take 250. Yeah, there could come a time here where I'd say 240. So you want to kind of go to the middle of the most recent comps, not the top of the most recent comps. You also need to change your offer strategy. I've been teaching since about 2016. People will pay 75 cents on the dollar less repair cost because the market's so hot. And I've also followed it up by saying, I might be saying something different next year, so pay attention. I'm saying something different this year. Your formula needs to be after repaired value times 0.7 minus repair costs. That's your sale price. That's not your offer price. Your offer price is ARV times 0.7 minus repair costs minus whatever you want your wholesale fee to be. Don't push that. If the correct offer, according to your math, is 150 and the seller says, well, I won't take less than 160, last year I probably would have put that under contract because I would have been like, yeah, I can push it a little bit. There aren't that many deals out there. Today I'd be like, well, let me know when you can. And then I would follow up. One other fun thing we need to talk about. There's this whole culture out there right now of what I call wholesale hustlers who will proudly tell you on Facebook that they have never taken a class, that you don't need to get educated, you just need to go out there and put properties under contract. You just need to go out and hustle. And thanks to those folks who seem proud of the fact that they just use the Zestimate as the value of the property and who have no idea what it costs to repair a property, like literally none. They use these formulas like, well, it's like $50 a square foot.
Yeah.
I don't even have to go look at the house. It's $50 a square foot. and they put properties under contract while telling sellers things like, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put you together with a buyer and I'm going to get paid. Mm-hmm. Does anybody know what the problem with that statement is? Okay, A, it's an incorrect statement. As a wholesaler, you don't put buyers and sellers together. As a wholesaler, you create an asset, which is your contract, and then you sell that asset. And then the buyer and seller might meet each other at the closing. Like, you're not putting buyers and sellers together. Problem number two is putting buyers and sellers together and getting paid for it is what real estate agents do. You have to have a license to do that. So they misunderstand. I honestly think some of them, that's what they think they do. They think they're being real estate agents. They just don't have a license. And some of them know what they do, but they say it wrong, right? And then they put houses under contract at prices where they can't possibly close because they don't know what the right price is, and then they've got fewer buyers out there than they used to and not so many dumb ones, and so the deal doesn't close, which upsets the sellers, who then complain to the realtors, the division of real estate, the newspaper. Like, I mean, a seller who is in trouble and needs this deal to close and has had a contract signed, and then at the last possible second, the plug is pulled on them, they're upset rightfully.
Angry.
Right? They're hurting sellers, and these sellers are going to be more vulnerable in the recession than they even usually are. So, thank you to the hustlers who have created an entire tidal wave of new anti-wholesaling legislation. Oklahoma, Illinois, and the city of Philadelphia, for some reason, have already passed laws that say if you don't have a real estate license, you cannot sell contracts. I think Illinois lets you do one a year. North Carolina and South Carolina and Tennessee have recently had either court cases or division of real estate announcements basically saying the same thing. Ohio is in the process. They really like the Oklahoma law. They want to pass the Oklahoma law.
Louisiana, Mississippi but specifically Louisiana.
Okay, Louisiana and Mississippi are talking about it. This isn't happening because wholesaling is bad. This is happening because some wholesalers are bad.
What's the Oklahoma law?
It says that you can't wholesale without a license, without a real estate license.
Very, very rough.
So, obviously, OREA is on this. They're putting together a committee to discuss it, and I am sincerely hoping I get to be on that committee because I am a real estate agent and I have some things to say about the fact that fraud is already illegal. You know, we don't need to double dip on that law. But it's just going to happen. I mean, I've been saying for 5 years, if you don't have a law in your state, get ready to have one, because we just cannot stop these bad actors from acting. So you need to prepare to either get a real estate license, which is not what I would suggest. That feels like giving in to, okay, so now I'm going to put myself under the control of the state and I'm going to pay all the fees and everything and to do that. And I don't know how having a real estate license makes wholesaling okay. Right? I mean, the whole thing about being a real estate agent is that you represent somebody in the transaction, and as a wholesaler, you 100% do not. I mean, you represent somebody, but it's you, right? You are not trying to get the seller the best price or trying to get the buyer the best price. You are trying to negotiate a deal where you make some money in between. It seems like the opposite of something a licensed real estate agent should be doing. Number two, you need to start lining up either private money or transactional funding to close your deals so that you can sell them. There's no laws against buying a property and selling it the next day, or the same day even, right? They're not trying to stop people from making good deals and reselling them. They're trying to stop them. Really what they're trying to stop them from doing is putting properties under contract with sellers and not closing them. That's what they're trying to stop. Number three, and this is probably your best option, never put a deal under contract that you would not be willing to own.
Yeah, that's good.
That's been my rule forever, which really helps with decisions about things like weird houses. You know, every once in a while you see like some really weird house, and being able to say, at what price would I be willing to own this house where one of the bedrooms you have to walk through the garage to get to? I mean, there is a price, but at what price would I be willing to own this property? Because that's the price at which I'm going to sell it.
No.
I mean, own as a rental, own as a lease option, own as a repair for equity deal. So that makes this a really good time for all the wholesalers to start doing what you should have been doing all along, which is cross train, because you do not want to be a wholesaler for your whole life. Wholesaling's kind of a job. If you want another check, you got to go work for the other check. The whole purpose of getting the checks is to get the experience in real estate and to get the money so that you can start buying houses so you can get passive income. And I don't even care if it's houses. It could be notes. Yeah, I don't care what you buy, but this is a step toward the passive income. It's not something to do for the rest of your life. No, that's not true. You can do it for the rest of your life, because the reason I still wholesale is because it pays for a lot of marketing, and some of the stuff that falls out of that marketing is long-term stuff, but I can also wholesale the stuff I don't want and get more cash for marketing and paying people and doing repairs to houses and all that sort of stuff. So your cross-training should be in a couple of areas. One is in creative finance strategies, because there's a lot of sellers that they need to sell. It's like there's no choice. Either they're going to sell or the sheriff's going to sell, right? But they can't sell at a cash price where you can then wholesale it. What they can do is they can do a takeover payments deal. And there are buyers out there for your takeover payments deals, but gosh, you need to have that set up very carefully to protect your seller. So you need to understand how to do that. You need to train in some kind of buying to hold thing. Now, I'll tell you the simplest one for wholesalers to get their brains around, because a lot of wholesalers are like, I'm not ready for tenants. It's repair for equity deals. That's what's going to happen to that house that I put under contract on Tuesday. We're not going to wholesale it. We're going to find a handy home buyer who can't qualify for a mortgage, and we're going to sell it to them probably on 30-year terms at a price that's less than the ARV, because he needs to do the work to bring it up to the ARV. There's nothing in there that is especially complicated to do. It's just a lot of little stuff. And the return on that, given that we're putting $4,000 down, will be huge. The monthly payments will be, you know, probably a few hundred dollars more than the monthly payments on the mortgage. So we won't have a tenant. We'll have a home buyer in the house. It'll be cash flow will be a lot more passive than managing a rental property. That is a really easy strategy for wholesalers to get their brains around, because it's like slow sailing. I'm still selling it. I'm just selling it on monthly payments. So here's what I'm doing right now with offers. We went to 70 cents on the dollar less repair costs back over the summertime. We had been at 75 cents. We're requiring 30 days to close. I've been telling sellers, you know, when they've got a competing offer, I'm like, how quick can they close? I can close as fast as title can be searched. Not doing that anymore. I'm saying we're probably going to need, we need to write the contract for 30 days. We'll close it sooner if we can. But the last wholesale deal we actually sold, which hasn't closed yet, but it's on the path to closing. We did the usual, send out texts, send out emails, call people thing, and we had two buyers who said, y'all come over and look at it. It normally would have been, we would have only made two calls, and there would have been two buyers. But there were a couple of dozen who were like, I don't know, I'm seeing what the market's doing. So you're probably going to need longer to sell than you have in the past. We're monitoring the situation to see if we need to move that to 45 days. because we have we did that in 2007. We moved it 45 days to close. I'm monitoring the market for, are we going to go back to buyers saying, I don't want to do so much work on a property? I only want stuff that needs below a certain amount of work. And monitoring it for the possibility of having to go to 65 cents on the dollar. So far, nah.
We went 65 now.
You did go 65?
Yeah, we're having a little bit of a different situation
there, though. Okay. As always, I collect my wholesale fees up front, not at closing. Because I want somebody who's serious enough that they're willing to put the money down now and they're not going to back out before closing and say, well, keep my $1,000. Now, if I've got your $10,000 and I'm not giving it back to you if you decide not to close, I know you're serious about closing and that you're sure you have your money lined up. Okay, so those next slides are sales pitch, which I'm not doing today. So, sure.
I'm sorry, the one before that.
The one before that. That one? Okay, so it is 10 o'clock, so we're supposed to be done, and also some idiot put me in back-to-back presentations today.
Same room, hopefully?
No, we have to go over there. That was me that did that. So, for questions, I will be in the bookstore with all the other presenters during the breaks and whatnot, not at lunch today because we've got an OREA board meeting, but certainly later today and tomorrow. And, try to not catch me if you see me running past you in the hall. But otherwise, and Bill and I are doing a 2:30 question and answer in here. And it would really annoy Bill if you guys had a bunch of wholesaling questions. So come in with your wholesaling questions as well. And hope you got some value here. Hope you will actually do what we talked about. And I'll see you over there in 30 minutes.